This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And later on in the programme, we will be bringing you the latest on today's hostage releases from Gaza and the planned release of Palestinian prisoners. That's coming up in about 25 minutes. But our top story today is that mid-air collision over Washington, D.C. late on Wednesday between an American Airlines flight coming in from Kansas and a military helicopter. 64 people were on board the passenger plane, three on the helicopter. The moment the crash happened was recorded by air traffic control. And you can make out audible gasps right after staff realised what had happened.
American 472, Oscar 1 star 3-2-3-1-7.
Did you see that?
American 472. American 3130, go around, turn left in 250-5-maintain-3000.
Jimmy Mazzeo was next to Ronald Reagan National Airport in Washington when he noticed unusual activity in the sky.
We looked up in the sky and we saw these white flare. We didn't think much of it. We thought they were like shooting stars. I don't know. I couldn't really explain it, but we didn't really think much of it until we saw the fire trucks start going out to the tarmac and the police cars and the police boats.
28 bodies have been recovered from the freezing Potomac River so far. John Donnelly is the Fire and Emergency Medical Services Chief for the District of Columbia.
Despite all those efforts, we are now at a point where we are switching from a rescue operation to a recovery operation. At this point, we don't believe there are any survivors from this accident. And we have recovered 27 people from the plane and one from the helicopter.
At a media briefing held in the past couple of hours, America's Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said that safety rules were not followed.
Safety is our expectation. Everyone who flies in American skies expects that we fly safely, that when you depart an airport, you get to your destination. That didn't happen last night. And I know that President Trump, his administration, the FAA, the DOT, we will not rest until we have answers for the families and for the flying public. You should be assured that when you fly, you're safe.
Robert Isom is the CEO of American Airlines. He offered his condolences to the victims of the crash.
I want to express my sincere condolences for the accident that happened at DCA last night. We're absolutely heartbroken for the family and loved ones of the passengers and crew members, and also for those that were on the military aircraft. Our focus right now is doing everything that we can to support all of those involved and also the PSA Airlines team. This is devastating. We are all hurting incredibly.
Well, let's talk to our correspondent, Namir Iqbal, who joins us live from Washington, D.C. And Namir, it is devastating. Also, the news that the rescue operation is now simply one of recovery.
I don't think that's too surprising either. It's been more than 10 hours now since this crash happened, and I'm just standing on a car park overlooking the main runway, and you can see the emergency crews on the scene. The plane is in three parts. It's submerged in waist-high, cold, frigid water. I mean, it was below freezing last night, and it's still incredibly cold here today. And so there was a sense of, you know, how could anyone have survived what had happened? But officials have confirmed that they don't expect there to be any survivors. And now the focus is very much on exactly what happened. I mean, I just also want to mention there is a military base here as well. And so it's very common to see military aircraft and civilian aircraft flying around in the skies here in DC. But the question is, how is it that, you know, both of them would have been on a set path? How is it that they collided?
Yes, and in the news conference that we've had in the past hour or so, that seemed to be repeated over and over again, and some bafflement amongst officials that there were these set paths and that both of the aircraft seemed to be on those paths.
Well, the passenger jet was on its final approach to the airport, said it was just minutes away from landing. And, you know, that would have been very clearly known in terms of the navigation systems. The military helicopters, this was a sort of a standard training exercise, and officials have said that there wasn't anything unusual about their flight patterns. But of course, you know, you played that clip just a moment ago, and so clearly something went wrong, that, you know, there was some sort of the controller told the helicopter pilot to pass behind, but, you know, why didn't the helicopter do that? What happened exactly? And we know that some of the black boxes have been recovered from the airliner, and it's just a case of, you know, this investigation now getting to the bottom of it. It's worth remembering as well that the Trump administration is sort of finding its feet. The Transport Secretary, Sean Duffy, was only sworn in yesterday, and it is the first week of the new Defence Secretary, his first week on the job, Pete Hegseth.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much, Nomi. Our correspondent Nomi Iqbal joining us live from close to the scene of the crash in Washington. Let's talk to Jeff Guzzetti, who's a former air accident investigator for the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board. Jeff joins us from Oklahoma City. Very good to have you with us. What do you think might have happened in this case?
Well, we know what happened, James. The two aircraft came together and collided. We just need to find out exactly why that happened. And it's probably going to be more than just a simple, a pilot failure to see something. You know, there's going to be root causes to this event. Communications between air traffic and the helicopter, what the helicopter was actually seeing, what the crew of the airliner was seeing as it was making its final approach in visual good weather conditions at night to a runway in at National Airport, which is a pretty congested airport. So two airplanes came together. It was a mid-air collision. Now we just have to determine exactly why these two airplanes came together without either the pilots or the controller. Maybe they did do what they were supposed to do. Maybe they didn't. That's what the investigation will determine.
And Jeff, just clarify for us, military helicopters, they're also under the same air traffic control, are they?
They are. They do communicate on different frequencies, though. Military uses ultra high frequency. Commercial airlines use very high frequency, but they're both in contact with the tower controller. In Washington, D.C., you have these what they call routes, helicopter routes, where you need to remain at 200 feet or below in certain little corridors, and then you just need to be in communication with the control tower. And in this case, it appears the helicopter was in communication with the control tower, and the controller did point out the traffic. The American Eagle flight, and the helicopter pilot indicated that he had the airplane in sight and was going to visually separate from it. And then the accident happened shortly thereafter. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of questions about what exactly did the helicopter pilot see? Were they wearing night vision goggles? And I'm sure there'll be some discussion about the congestion moving forward with this airport.
Yeah. Also, are there automated systems on both the sort of helicopter that was flying Black Hawk and passenger planes to provide a sort of ultimate backstop, that something will start beeping if a collision looks imminent?
Yes and no. So certainly the American Eagle airliner has something installed on it, like all airliners, called Traffic Collision and Alerting TCAS, Traffic Alert and Collision Avoidance System. And it will give an aural warning if you're getting too close to an aircraft. But the issue is that software mutes those signals whenever you're very close to the ground, because at that point, you've got the runway in sight. And I don't even know if the TCAS system provided an alert. And even if it would it have really made any difference? But you can be sure that the investigation is going to look into that technology.
And just a final brief word on that investigation. How long, how complex can these be?
You know, this one I don't think is going to be very complex. But I still think that investigators you're not going to really hear much in terms of a final cause for at least a year, maybe a year and a half, because it just takes time to make sure you get everything right and you produce the report and you vet the report. So I'm sure we'll get some preliminary indications over the next few days, but in terms of the final cause, it's going to be at least 1 year.
Jeff, thank you very much indeed for coming on today. Jeff Guzzetti, former air accident investigator. Well, let's hear now from John Tyshert, who's a retired US Air Force Brigadier General. He was commander of Joint Base Andrews, the US military airbase just outside of Washington, D.C., where Air Force One is located. He's also a veteran combat pilot and test pilot. He's been giving his view of what's happened to my colleague Sarah Montague.
This commercial airliner was on short final to land to the northwest at Reagan National. The military aircraft does have a bit more freedom of maneuver, but all of the pilots in the military that fly in this congested and prescripted airspace are highly trained and qualified. And really, the investigators are going to get to the root cause of this, but likely confusion and communication are going to play major roles in the root cause of what happened last night.
Okay. Can you help us in this? Because you know it so well, that area, the airspace above Washington. How is it managed between the military and civilian planes?
These two aircraft, just like all the aircraft in the area, would have been on a common frequency, which means that the air traffic controllers on the ground would be speaking to both of them. And again, a key part of this investigation will be to get those tapes of what was being said and then get those black boxes or flight recorders so that we can see not only what was said, but what was said within the cockpits themselves to try to understand what the root cause is, if it was confusion, which it seems to be.
Mm. And so what's your hunch on what the likely outcome is?
Sarah, I do think that there was some sort of confusion specifically with the helicopter, and rewinding those communication tapes 5 minutes or so would give us the holistic context of what was going on to manage the deconfliction that is necessary in that congested airspace. And the investigators, both from the Army and the Department of Transportation, will be quarantining the perishable evidence as quickly as possible. They'll be figuring out what happened, but most importantly, why it happened, so we can get to the root cause and hopefully prevent anything like this from happening again.
So what the question from air traffic control, have you seen it? It wasn't necessarily clear what he'd seen.
That is true. And it is a very populated area with a lot of lights on the ground and air traffic. And so potentially the confusion could have been that there are two landing runways at Reagan National, one directly to the north, one to the northwest. And if the pilot was looking for a landing aircraft on one, they might have been blind and not looking for an aircraft landing on the other.
And that was John Tyshert, former commander of Andrews Air Force Base just outside Washington, D.C. All the latest updates here on the BBC and on the BBC website, bbc.com/news, a live page up and running, including the latest from a news conference taking place in Kansas. That's where the American Airlines plane took off from. And coming up on the program, we'll hear about a new study that's found that the Zika virus causes changes to human skin to make us smell more attractive to the mosquitoes that carry the disease.
They need the mosquitoes to be from one body going to another body. Then because of that, they're changing our machinery in our cells, in the skin cells, and then they make us to smell better for Aedes mosquitoes, which are the one they transmit Zika virus.
More on that coming up in just over 10 minutes. Our main headlines from the BBC newsroom this hour. Israel's delayed the release of Palestinian prisoners agreed in the Gaza ceasefire deal in protest at the chaotic handover of Israeli and Thai hostages earlier on Thursday. And the former German Chancellor has rebuked the leader of her party for relying on far-right support during a vote in Parliament. This is James Menendez with News Hour live from the BBC. Let's turn to the Middle East now. A little later, we will be hearing about the latest hostage releases from Gaza. But first to another big story there. From today, an Israeli ban on the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees working in Israel and East Jerusalem comes into force. The head of UNRWA, as it's known, says the ban will, quote, cripple the organization's ability to provide education, healthcare, and even food to people in Gaza and the occupied occupied West Bank. It employs 13,000 people in Gaza alone. The ban was introduced by the Israeli parliament in October last year, following allegations that several UNRWA workers were involved in the deadly Hamas attack on Israel on October the 7th. Well, let's talk to David Mensah, Israeli government spokesman in the Prime Minister's office. Thank you for joining us here on NewsHour. We knew this ban was coming, but not perhaps how it's going to be implemented. How will you enforce it?
So firstly, from the government of Israel's perspective, I can provide the assurance that Israel's completely committed to the uninterrupted flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza to provide uninterrupted aid to those that need it. And of course, Israel will always operate and will continue to operate in full compliance with international law. But the case against UNRWA was very, very clear. UNRWA are still fixated with this single-digit figures in terms of the number of people involved in terrorism. Our figures...
Yes, nine. It did two separate investigations, yes, and found 9 out of 13,000.
Yeah. Well, you know the old poacher gamekeeper scenario. This was a classic case. Israel's investigation found that 1,200 of UNRWA staff were actually also in Hamas. That means teachers, that means people involved in siphoning off the aid, which should have been going to hungry Palestinians and Gazans, was siphoned off to Hamas.
Where is the evidence for that? Because that hasn't ever been presented publicly. And in fact, on the several staff who faced those initial allegations, the UN never had any written evidence from your government.
So we have, of course, James, provided all the evidence. We've provided it to Philip Lazzarini. We've provided it to Secretary General Guterres. They've all been informed. On UNRWA, it's very clear now that if a government like the UK, for instance, wants to support the Palestinians or Gazans, then the last thing they should do is support UNRWA, because if a state supports UNRWA, it is funding terrorism.
The United Nations has been clear that without UNRWA, that delivery of aid will not be possible. I mentioned that quote from Philippe Lazzarini, who said that the ban would cripple the organisation's ability to provide education, healthcare and so on to Gaza and the occupied West Bank. And Israel has obligations to those territories as an occupying power, doesn't it?
So I've already outlined our obligation, and that is a commitment to keep getting aid in. Philip Lazzarini, unfortunately, is...
But how is that going to be distributed without UNRWA? That's what I'm not clear.
I'll tell you, James, if you let me talk. I will tell you, James, if you let me answer your questions. In December 2024, UNRWA contributed a pathetic 0.6% of Gazans humanitarian aid. Okay, now, if you're looking about the way forward, we have certainly thought about that. The way forward is clear. It's to redirect aid to UN agencies and other NGOs that do work. Agencies like the World Food Programme, like UNICEF, like UNOPS, they already operate in Gaza and provide aid without the baggage of terror ties. If you want a better future for Gazans, as we all do here in the Israeli government, we don't want to be back at war in another couple of years' time, then these other agencies have got a proven track record of efficiency and accountability and not being tied to terrorism.
Well, let's hear from UNRWA now. David, thank you very much indeed. David Mensah, Israeli government spokesman, joining us live. Let's speak to Juliet Tuma, who's UNRWA's Director of Communications based in Amman in Jordan. Juliet, thanks for being with us. And just on that last point from David Mensah, UNRWA providing just 0.6% of aid, is that right? And can other UN agencies fill the gap?
Thanks for having me. Look, since the ceasefire kicks in just over 10 days ago, UNRWA brought in 60% of all aid that went into Gaza and also distributed that aid across the Gaza Strip, including in areas that are extremely hard to access, like the north of Gaza.
So what would happen if UNRWA is unable to operate?
Look, if we're not able to operate, it will be catastrophic for the people that we serve, not only in Gaza, who rely on UNRWA for their sheer survival, But in parts of the West Bank, where, for one example, we provide schools for 50,000 boys and girls, and no other UN agency does that type of work, that direct delivery service provision of education and primary healthcare.
What's your understanding of how this ban is going to be enforced? Because it seems to stipulate that there can be no contact between UNRWA staff and Israeli officials. What will that mean in practice?
I don't know, because thus far we've not received communication from the government of Israel on how they plan to implement those bills. What we do know is that stopped giving visas to UNRWA staff. They expired those visas for humanitarian staff working out of Jerusalem.
And is that just to be clear, is that international staff working for the agency?
Absolutely, international staff, thank you. And they were forced to leave Jerusalem yesterday. However, our operations continue. We are staying and delivering. Our clinics are open, including in East Jerusalem. The humanitarian operation in Gaza continues.
Right, so at the moment, things are carrying on as normal, if I can use that word.
We will continue to stay and deliver until we cannot.
And what might stop that? Presumably there do need to be some contacts with Israeli officials. I mean, my understanding, for example, about the staffing of UNRWA is that now the agency is what? Contacting Israel every quarter with lists of staff, partly in case there are problems with staff having affiliations to an organization like Hamas.
Look, not only that, we work very closely with the Israeli army because they help us facilitate the delivery of the trucks that are coming into Gaza, including trucks of fuel, by the way. So we have to coordinate that with the Israeli army. Now, whether this will stop or not, I still do not know that.
If it does, though, will that seriously cause your work to grind to a halt?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, how are we going to operate? How are we going to bring the supplies in? How are we going to deconflict what we call so that our convoys are not hit during a movement? So absolutely fundamental that we continue. Also fundamental for the success and the continuation of the ceasefire, because without UNRWA in Gaza, the likelihood of this ceasefire falling apart is very high.
Juliet, thank you very much. Juliet Toomer, UNRWA's Director of Communications, joining us live there from Amman in Jordan. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. As I mentioned, we'll be staying with the Middle East in a few minutes. We'll be hearing about some chaotic scenes at the latest release of hostages from Gaza and what that means for Palestinian detainees being released in return. That's coming up in about 5 minutes' time here on the BBC. And welcome back to NewsHour. A new study has found that the Zika virus causes metabolic changes to human skin to make us smell much more attractive to the mosquitoes that carry the disease. Most Zika infections either don't lead to disease or they cause only mild symptoms, but in some cases they can be much more serious, especially for pregnant women. A decade ago, an outbreak in Brazil led to brain development problems in thousands of babies. Nusheen Emami is co-lead author of the study published in the journal Nature. She's a researcher at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine.
Basically, Zika virus, for its own transmission and survival, they need the mosquitoes to be from one body going to another body. Then because of that, they changing our machinery in our cells, in the skin cells, and then they make us to smell better for Aedes mosquitoes, which are the one they transmit Zika virus.
So we smell better to those mosquitoes, and then the chances of a mosquito landing on our skin and therefore potentially biting and infecting us are higher.
Exactly. The chance of basically landing on us and probing on our body is getting higher. They get the disease and they can transmit it to another person.
So this suggests that the Zika virus, I guess, like all organisms, is active, not passive, active in its desire to spread itself as far as it possibly can.
You are absolutely correct. But virus, because it's very simple and doesn't have any, you know, complicated organs like parasites, for the other scientists, it's very difficult to think it is actually the active process. But we confirmed the active because Zika is getting hand in hand with our fibroblast machinery, and they can just transmit and survive.
So what does this mean for the treatment of Zika, but the prevention of Zika more, isn't it? Is there any way to target that mechanism to stop our skin smelling attractive to those mosquitoes?
No, we don't have anything so far, but this research highlights this discovery, which is we can find a better mechanisms, or actually with the same mechanism we're introducing, we're going with different pathways to block that smell. And then in that way, virus cannot send signal to the mosquitoes. That is one of the future discoveries.
And is it possible, if this isn't a stupid question, I mean, is it possible that we could just develop some sort of spray for people living in Zika-prone areas, or perhaps when there's an outbreak, that people could spray on their skin that might deter the mosquitoes?
That is one of the ways. We call it repellent. We can just basically find one of the discovery or product can be find materials to mask this smell over the human body or infected body. And then we block the transmission in that kind of regard. But we can also make a trap. We can use this signal, which is the trick Zika virus used for its own transmission and survival. We use this signal, we add it to the traps, we attract that mosquitoes towards that trap and we kill them.
And that was Nushin Emami from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine and co-lead author of that new study into Zika. You're listening to News Hour live from the BBC World Service. I'm James Menendez. Now, there have been some chaotic scenes during the latest handover of 7 hostages in southern Gaza. Armed militants push back surging crowds of Palestinians as 2 Israeli civilians, Gadi Moses and Abel Yehud, were escorted into Red Cross vehicles. Mr. Moses is an 80-year-old grandfather. 5 Thai farm workers who were abducted during the October the 7th attacks by Hamas have also been freed today. And earlier, an Israeli soldier, Agam Berger, was released. She's been reunited with her family, who cheered as she was handed over to the Red Cross. Well, as I say, also released were 5 Thai hostages. Wirara Srion, the mother of one of the released, was watching a live stream of a vehicle moving slowly through a cheering crowd in Gaza.
We've been waiting for over a year, hoping and praying for him to come back to us. This is what we've been praying for every day. In the end, there was no warning, nothing to prepare us for this. A couple of days ago, there was no sign. But when we spoke to the church clerk, they said, it won't be long now. It won't be long before there's good news.
Well, under the terms of the truce, 110 Palestinians are due to be freed from Israeli jails today in exchange for the hostages' release. And that's in protest at the way it was all conducted. Let's talk to our correspondent, Nick Beek, who joins us now from Tel Aviv. Nick, what is the latest on that? Are those 110 Palestinians, are they going to be freed today?
We don't know for sure, James, but the indications are they may well have found a solution to this, because earlier on we heard very strong language from Prime Minister Netanyahu and other politicians here in Israel saying that what was playing out earlier in Khan Yunis during the release of Abel Yehud in particular, the 29-year-old civilian hostage who was surrounded by hundreds of gunmen and other fighters and looked very, very distressed. And there was this crowd that was moving and it seemed to go on and on and on. There was real condemnation of that. The Israelis said they delayed the release of these 110 Palestinian prisoners. Then we heard from Hamas saying that mediators had intervened, some sort of an agreement was made. Then we heard from the Palestinian prisoners office saying actually at 5 p.m. local time, so about 20 minutes from now, about sort of 3 o'clock UK time, that there would be these releases. So it's not been confirmed, James, but it does seem that this has been resolved, and the Prime Minister's office, Mr. Netanyahu's office, saying that mediators have now delivered a commitment that a safe exit will be guaranteed for the other hostages who will be released in the next rounds to come. So it does seem that they've potentially worked this out.
And just tell us a bit more about the Israeli government's objections. As you say, one of the hostages did seem to be in some distress, but is it also about the way that Hamas and other militants seem to be using these occasions?
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, where I am in Hostages Square in the middle of Tel Aviv, people were watching events unfold on the big screen. And I think the sense you get from people here is that, bearing in mind how the first two releases unfolded, there is this element of propaganda, choreography from Hamas. The fact that once again the first hostage who was released today, Agam Berger, was taken up onto a stage. She had this sort of certificate, these items in a bag that she'd been given to sort of mark this 15 months in captivity. Clearly people find that really distasteful. But I think what took it to another level was the way in which that Arbel Yehud and Gadi Moses, who's 80 years old, were sort of forced through this crowd of people, which was completely chaotic with no choreography, it would seem. So I think it was that that really angered people.
Just a quick one, Nick, on the Thai hostages. Five released today, which I think leaves one Thai hostage unaccounted for. Do we know what's happened to him?
No, we don't, James. No, not at the moment. The Thai Ministry of Foreign Affairs has confirmed that the five released today have been looked after and met by officials who presumably would have travelled out from Bangkok or elsewhere. As you say, the sixth hostage, not clear their fate. There were two others who were thought to have been taken during the October the 7th attacks. They are dead. That's the assumption there. That's what officials have said. So, yeah, no clarity on that sixth Thai hostage.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Nick Beek joining us from Tel Aviv. Well, we can talk also to our correspondent, Wera Davis, who's in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. And Wera, what are you hearing about those 110 Palestinians and perhaps the timing of when they might be released?
Well, of course, it's an expectant atmosphere here. People have been gathering all day, perhaps expecting that there would be delays. One daughter who's awaiting her father's release told me, you know, I'm used to waiting. I'm used to getting ready and preparing myself for my father's release, and it never happens. So they're fairly pragmatic and phlegmatic about it all, but they've been reassured that the 110 prisoners will be released at about 5 o'clock local time, and that it'll take about an hour for them to get to this reception centre in Ramallah. Now, of those 110 prisoners being released, about 63 of them are thought to be going to be released to the occupied West Bank. A handful are going to go to occupied East Jerusalem, where they've been warned by the occupying Israeli authorities there not to celebrate publicly. So that will probably be passed off quite quietly over in East Jerusalem. And then about 21 of the most serious offenders, those who've been in Israeli jails with for longer terms and have been convicted of the most serious offences, they're not being allowed by the Israelis to return to occupied Palestinian territory. They're being exiled through Gaza to countries like Egypt and others in the region. So people are worried, they're disappointed here that it hasn't happened already, but they expect their family members to be handed over at some point this evening.
And some of those who haven't been in detention for very long, what sort of things were they sent to prison for?
That's a good one. I mean, the range of sentences, extend from multiple counts of murder to no charges at all. There are several people who've been in what they call preventative detention. So they haven't been formally convicted of anything, but they've been in prolonged Israeli detention. That often happens to younger people. We know that among the 60 or so being released today to the occupied West Bank, there are thought to be about 30 women and children. The youngest person is thought to be about 15 years old. And, you know, children are often detained for things maybe people would find as innocuous as throwing stones or participating in violent demonstrations. But yeah, it does appear that a number of the people who will be handed over today are minors, are children.
Wera, thank you very much indeed for that update. Wera Davis joining us live there from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. President Trump's executive order last week freezing overseas aid for 90 days has had consequences far and wide. Take northeast Syria, a part of the country largely controlled by Kurdish forces, a US ally, and also home to thousands of ISIS fighters and their families held in vast sprawling detention camps. Much of the funding for these open-air prisons comes from the United States, but that suddenly dried up when the order was issued. The BBC's G.R. Goll has been to one of the camps, Al-Hol, to find out more.
Al-Hol camp is so massive. I mean, it looked like a tent city. There are around 40,000 ISIS family members there. I mean, it's not just the family members. There are, they say, around 4,500 ISIS militants in the prison, actually not far from the place I'm talking to you at this moment.
And some of the funding for the camp comes from the United States. So what happened when Donald Trump announced that freezing of federal aid?
The head of the camp said it was unwarned. Nobody warned them that was coming. She said one NGO supposed to repatriate 500 Iraqis to Iraq, they stopped because they didn't have money to pay for the guard. And also she said the NGO that normally deliver breads didn't show up. So there was a chaos. So many people were worried what will happen to the, and also we went to different parts of this camp. It's very dangerous. The only way to go around it was with armored vehicle. The kids are so radicalized. They still showing ISIS symbols, shouting Allahu Akbar, God is great, and they are so radicalized, and the authority there were so worried if the guard don't show up, if they cannot feed them, there might be a riot. If they escape, it will be a security threat for the region.
So as I understand it, at least for now, the funding has been restored, but long term, if the United States decides to stop supporting the Kurds and decides to stop giving money to maintain camps like Al-Hol, I mean, who would step in? Would the Kurds do it anyway, or is there a danger the camp would just break up?
I don't think the Kurds can do it because they have been surrounded. In one side is a Syrian new government, which they don't have a good relation. One part is Turkey, very hostile to this region. So I don't believe in any ways they would be able to take care of that camp, because it's not just that camp. There are many other camps around this region because of the war. So many people from Syria, from other parts of north and east of Syria, moved to this area because it was safe. ISIS was forced out. So there are massive camps anywhere you travel, from Raqqa to Kobani to different places northeast. You see camps. United States, as a major donor, if they pull out their aid, there will be a disaster definitely in this region.
And GR, just finally, I mean, you mentioned Turkey, deep hostility between Turkey and the Kurds. Has that stepped up in recent days and weeks? And I just wonder what that might mean for what is going on at Al-Hol. In other words, are the Kurds having to think about attacks from Turkey rather than their responsibilities to keep those ISIS detainees locked up?
Yes, James. I have been here in the past 3-4 days. I'm in Hasaka, by the way, northeast of Syria. And I was in Kobani near Tashrin and Minbij, which is fierce fighting going on there between the Kurdish Democratic Forces and with Jaysh al-Vatani, Islamist militants backed by Turkey. There is a massive fight going on. At this moment, I'm talking to you, I'm watching the television here just an hour ago, a convoy of civilians going to Tashrin them. They are against the war. They were attacked, and that has been the scene. Today, Human Rights Watch issued a report. It says attacking ambulance and Red Crescent in that region by Turkish-backed Syrian militants are war crimes. People are so angry.
And that was BBC's G.R. Goll speaking to me there from northeast Syria. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. Still more to come. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Now, a painting sold for $50 at a Minnesota garage sale could be an original Van Gogh worth $15 million, according to some experts. It's not the first suspected piece by the Dutch master, and requests for official authentication by Amsterdam's Van Gogh Museum are now by invitation only after they surge to some 500 a year. Well, the American art research firm LMI has hired over a dozen experts in the hopes that this work, depicting a pipe-smoking fisherman, will prove to be genuine. And Jennifer Mass is one of those experts. She's the founder and president of Scientific Analysis of Fine Art, a company that provides authentication and attribution. Jennifer, welcome to the programme. $64,000 question. Is this a real Van Gogh, do you think?
Thank you so much for having me, James. Well, great start with the question. I have been working on this painting for 3 years now, and in general, it is my role to have data and not necessarily have an opinion. But after spending, 30 years, my entire career, looking at works of art, of course, I do have an opinion. And I have to say that I started out appropriately scientifically skeptical, and in literally the past month or so, I am starting to feel quite positive, quite confident about this work.
Okay. that's pretty good going. What happens then? So you and the other experts put forward a dossier of what you think is the evidence, and then who decides? Is it the Van Gogh Museum who has the final say?
Also an excellent question. And so traditionally in the art market, there'll be, one or two art historians that will be the deciders, that every painting has to go before them. And yes, the Van Gogh Museum has played that role, absolutely. And in some sense, their job, very appropriately, is to always say no, because they are really protecting his reputation and our understanding of the history of his work. But they have changed their minds over time. And it's all a matter of the information that we can present the museum with, just so we can go beyond connoisseurship, which is absolutely critical. And none of the technology and science that we do is ever going to replace the connoisseurship, but it is also critical in terms of coming up with a positive attribution. And so the LMI group that I'm working with, they are profoundly data-driven. And so the type of materials data that I collect and techniques on the paintings, that's just part of the data that we're collecting on an artwork.
Jennifer, just in the last sort of 40 seconds we've got, I mean, if it does turn out to be genuine, how significant would this be? I mean, it's quite a find, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And I think what's fascinating about Van Gogh is that he's done approximately 900 paintings, and yet in the public eye, we get to see the same, 70 to 100 paintings over and over again. And there's so much more to the artist than that. And so this painting, while it might look unusual, for example, compared to Starry Night, it actually fits in perfectly with what he was doing in this particular point in his career, turning back to the earlier palette he used in the Netherlands.
Jennifer, thank you very much indeed. Very good to talk to you, Jennifer Mass of that art research firm LMI. Now, a new film from Brazil, I'm Still Here, is breaking box office records and collecting a raft of award nominations, including a nod for the Oscar for Best Picture, a first for a Brazilian movie in Portuguese. I'm Still Here is a historical and political drama based on a real story, and it's a story that's touched a raw nerve for people in Brazil and its diaspora abroad. From New York, Tom Brook reports.
The film I'm Still Here is set in Brazil in the 1970s, when the country was living under a military dictatorship.
Documentos. Anda, anda!
Nós vamos sorrir.
So heal.
At the centre of this story, based on real events, is Onisi Paiva, played by Fernanda Torres, whose seemingly joyous family life is changed forever when her husband, Rubens, a former leftist congressman, disappears after he is apprehended by the military.
Não, não tem engano nenhum, não. O senhor vem com a gente.
In Brazil, the film has been a big box office success and it's brought the country its first ever Oscar Best Picture nomination for a film in Portuguese, as well as nominations for Best International Feature and for Fernanda Torres for Best Actress. It's a big shot in the arm for Brazilian cinema. Rodrigo Brandão is a Brazilian filmmaker.
This is really about a topic that people are talking about on the streets right now. What is the value of democracy? You know, should we fight for democracy in Brazil? And so this film really captures that.
The film was launched at the Venice Film Festival last year, where top Brazilian filmmaker Walter Salles explained how he was moved to tell the story of Onisi Paiva's response to her husband's forced, violent disappearance.
It was an extraordinary story of a family enduring an act of violence, and with a woman redefining herself in the middle of it. I fell in love with that woman.
That woman is Onisi Paiva, played by Fernanda Torres, who's now a strong Oscar contender. But the actor's chances of winning may have been weakened because a comedy sketch from 20 years ago, in which she appeared in blackface, recently resurfaced. She has apologized, stating that when she performed the sketch, the racist history of blackface hadn't yet entered mainstream consciousness in Brazil. Torres maintains that in I'm Still Here, she tried to stay truthful to her character, who prevailed in the wake of her husband's disappearance to emerge as an activist for the rights of indigenous people.
That's what we tried, I think, to be faithful to this woman that believed that the way to fight against dictatorship and authoritarianism was through education and justice.
I'm Still Here has also been embraced enthusiastically by audiences and critics outside Brazil. In the Brazilian community in Astoria, New York, there's a great sense of pride that Brazilian cinema has been recognized by the Academy's 10,000 Oscar voters.
For us, it's like the World Cup. It's amazing. We're very proud and happy.
It's so nice to see that my country is being recognized for such a critical situation in Brazil.
Quite apart from its political themes, the film is important to Brazilians for sentimental reasons. The film's leading lady, Fernanda Torres, appears in a picture which also features a performance from Fernanda Montenegro, her 95-year-old mother. 25 years ago, she was nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars but lost to Gwyneth Paltrow. So now the country is rooting for her daughter to make history and finally bring home the Oscars gold to Brazil.
Tom Brooke reporting there from New York. And that brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. Thank you so much for being with us. Until the next time, I'll be back tomorrow, in fact. Do take care. Bye-bye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to
speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.